Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. My colleague and co-host Sam Wong isn't with us today. This year has been a really stunning period in the history of gender politics. The Me Too movement has really transformed American political debate. It's had a huge impact on powerful leaders and figures in multiple arenas, from entertainment to politics, and many observers believe that it could play a very important role in mobilizing voters during the midterm campaigns in 2018, as well as the 2020 election. Though none of the concerns raised are new, we've been debating these issues for a long time, the speed through which this particular movement has taken on allegations of sexual harassment and violence and the downfall of figures such as Harvey Weinstein has taken some by surprise. Just as important, the movement's having real traction in public discussions and political organization and in our public consciousness. And at the same time, some have noted that there have, at least until now, been some limits in terms of what kinds of policy changes have been enacted, how the media discusses these issues, and questions about whether the nation will have the attention span to continue this discussion. Today we have with us the award-winning actress Amber Tamblyn, who is the author of a powerful new book, Any Man, which has just been published by Harper Perennial. Amber is an extraordinary figure. In addition to her impressive resume acting, she's also published a poetry collection called Dark Sparkler and two other books, Free Stallion, which won the Borders Book Choice Award for Breakout Writing, and Bang Ditto, an indie next bestseller. She writes poetry reviews for Bust Magazine. She's been a poet in residence at Amy Poehler's Smart Girl and contributes to the New York Times, and her work has appeared in many, many other outlets. And this is all in addition to her roles in television shows such as Two and a Half Men, Inside with Amy Schumer, as well as her widely praised film recently, Paint It Black. She's also the co-founder of Time's Up, a legal defense fund to help those who have experienced sexual harassment and violence. Amber, welcome to Politics and Polls.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maybe we can start by talking about when you began working on Any Man.
I started working on Any Man maybe about 3.5 years ago, shortly before the 2016 election. Or sorry, yes, election and campaign, but somewhere at the end of middle of 2015 and writing it, sort of the bulk of it and the outline for it in 2016.
And you wrote an op-ed in 2017, which got a lot of attention, I'm Done With Not Being Believed. In it, you wrote a little, a snippet of it is, every day women across the country consider the risks. That is our day job and our night shift. We have a diploma in risk consideration. Consider the skirt, consider the dark alley, consider questioning your boss, consider what your daughter will think of you, consider what your mother will think of what your daughter will think of you, consider how it will be twisted and used against you in a court of law, consider whether you did perhaps really ask for it, consider your weight, consider dieting, consider agelessness, consider silence. How did these feelings and some of the sentiment you expressed in the op-ed, how important were those in the construction of the novel?
I think that, you know, they're slightly connected. I think that ultimately this book is, you know, a accumulation of long-term female rage in a certain way, while also trying to explore what it means to empathize with somebody else. And I can definitely say, as a woman, that I have experienced both of those things, in the sense of also not being able to have people empathize with my experience as a woman, which is so much of, I think, what the Me Too movement turned out to be about, was just this need for people who were not us to know really what it's like, what the experience is like outside of just sexual assault, but everything that comes after that. So the book aimed more, I think, towards exploring different ways in which to approach a subject that has been approached many times before, and frankly, I think that we are a little numb to as a society, and that is sexual assault.
And before we jump into the book, the term female rage is a powerful term. What does that mean to you, or how do you invoke that?
That's a really good question. I think that female rage is very different for very different women. I think as for a lot of women, we've always been really taught that our emotionality does not count, and that the only thought that really counts in the broader scheme of things is rational thought. You know, men predominantly tell us that, and that emotional thought has no place in creating action or making decisions. I agree with that on certain levels, but I also think it's almost impossible to dismiss half of the world's population as simply just being not important in that way. And I think that so much of women's intellect comes from their emotional instincts. And if we could lean a little further into that, we might know what a world would look like that had more female thought applied to it in a macro sense. And by that, I mean having more women in positions of power. When I say emotional, most people think of like a crying lady. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the many different ways in which women are capable of being empathic, and how that could affect the world at large. And so one of the things we're seeing right now is anger. And really, we haven't seen that in a very long time en masse, where there is a large sense of a constituency of women who are furious and frankly just not going to be quiet about it in the way that we've always been told is better for us to do.
Yeah, it's interesting in that whenever there are movements of this sort, social movements, anger is often a driving feeling. If in the civil rights movement, this was integral in the 1960s. And
yes, absolutely.
For all the talk we have about civility and being calm, we have to remember that frustration and anger often, that's the motivator for some of the biggest changes we've had.
I think, I think there'll be plenty of time for that. I think we're seeing a little bit of it, you know, right now in the sense of even within the Me Too movement of just how do we broaden the conversation and how do we fundamentally change things, you know, for the better for everyone. And part of that is we have to figure out a way for men to empathize and understand, not just see what we go through, but feel what we go through. But, you know, that wasn't the case several months ago. And women needed their space to be able to tell their stories. And frankly, we just needed men, most men, because there were also some men that were also sharing their own stories during the Me Too movement, but to basically, for the most part, just be quiet and listen. It was an exercise in that. And for once saying, your opinion doesn't matter in this arena. Let us speak and let us be heard. So I think that there's space for those things to move. And I am not of the opinion, for instance, even, you know, looking at the country as a whole, that we need to come together right now. People talk about that all the time, the sense of like, we should be coming together. We're so divided. We're more divided than ever. And I just think that we need to be able to sit in that uncomfortable space as a country and really figure out what we're made of, and who we are and what we want and lines we won't cross. And that doesn't necessarily mean, coming together all the time. So I am all for, taking the harder road in order to achieve, something important at the end of it.
And so your immediate contribution right now is this book, which is it's a terrific book just as a read. But it also obviously connects directly to this conversation that's happening. Maybe you could just tell us, obviously without giving it away, a little bit about the story.
Yeah. So the story, the book is called Any Man, and it follows the lives of six survivors of sexual assault who happen to all be men. And in this story, the perpetrator is a female serial rapist. So she is attacking these men, and she sort of is a very amorphous creature who not only has attacked them, but then also sort of haunts them at the same time, haunts them, their memories, and then also at large society that also is not able to find her in certain terms. So it's really a look at both the experience that sexual assault survivors have after the actual event of an attack, and what their lives look like afterwards. And it's also kind of an indictment of our media and our culture and our 24-hour news cycle.
And so the first question, and I'm sure you get this, or you will get a lot of this, is why did you decide to switch the perspective, so to speak, to make the victims male and the rapist a female? What was the thinking behind that?
So I do get asked that question, and I do get asked about, you do hear the words either switching or reversing. Mm-hmm. And I never saw it that way. I always just saw it as expanding. I think that there is many worlds in which women are inherently violent and that there is no cause or rhyme or reason for why they are violent. It may not be in this particular type of a way, but I think that that is a trope and an archetype that we have been burdened with, that women, you know, in order to be anything powerful, we must also figure out a way to be nurturing. We must also figure out a way to be graceful and kind. Meanwhile, also be attractive while all those other things. And I think that the same is true for men, that there are whole emotional worlds for men to be explored in the worlds of art that we don't get to show enough, and that it is a reality that some men are sexually assaulted. A lot are actually, and a lot of them are by women. So I just wanted to broaden that and bring them into the conversation, bring more men into the conversation, to sort of broaden what they see and how they see it, while also reclaiming the archetype of what a woman is allowed to be.
Can I ask, one of the things that seems to get to the heart of what you're doing, I've seen in discussions that you've had about your work, about the need to examine the quote unquote rape culture that has such a powerful hold. Can you unpack what that means, the rape culture, so that people understand?
Well, it's the, when we're talking about rape culture, it is the culture, that word, that part of the term that I most explore and am interested in. And when I talk about the culture, I'm talking about, you know, the world that monetizes it, that glorifies it in a certain way, and also, you know, turns the very acts and experiences of people who are sexually assaulted into sort of almost turns them into celebrities in a certain way, whether or not they actually are. There's a celebritizing of the experience. And so when I look at that, and then, you know, against that, you know, that's a short-term experience for most people, if any person at all. And then afterwards, they're just forgotten. You know, the media will pound your door down in any way possible to get a hold of you for a quote, for an interview, to talk about, you know, the latest allegations or indictments of a particular individual. And then the next day, it's like you never existed. And I know that to be a true experience for a lot of women, especially coming out of the Me Too movement. And so there is an inherent violence in that type of attitude. There's also an inherent violence within the world of social media, which I think goes back and forth with being incredibly productive and helpful, and then also being a breeding ground for bullying at the same time. So for me, I wanted to really look at the culture, not just when we think of culture, do we think of, you know, guys who sexually assault and then the people that protect them. Yes, that's one aspect. But let's go out further. Let's look further out at the lens and really question whether or not we ourselves are complicit in this behavior. I think it's one of the things that Michelle Wolf, feel how anyone wants to about her, did so poignantly at that White House correspondence dinner, is that she was able to turn the mirror around and reflect it on the very room in which those people were sitting. And they didn't like it. You know, you can talk, we can talk about she went too far this way or that. But at the end of the day, what she did was extremely honest. And that was really hard for that that community of people to sit with, their own complicitness in all of this.
Yeah, I was there, and I remember the most powerful part of it wasn't actually the discussion of Sanders. It was about the media and kind of how the media has affected the news and the many problems from networks to newspapers. And that's when the real silence in the room took place, even though the coverage afterwards was obviously about Sarah Sanders. So yeah. I agree that was a powerful part of the piece that she did.
Yeah, and I have been to that correspondence dinner myself personally a few times before, and it is very self-congratulating. And, you know, I get it. Reporters work really hard, journalists work really hard, and they themselves have to walk and toe a very careful line. But that shouldn't stop us from, you know, from having these difficult conversations and sometimes calling people out when it's absolutely necessary.
And you have in the so the book for people listening moves different kinds of narrative. You have narratives, you have email exchanges, you have tweets, and we can talk about that. But one of the most amazing exchanges for me when I read it was between a television producer for a legal show named Marsha and one of the victims. And you have the email exchange as she's trying to book him for the show. And, you know, the first email says, as you know, Melissa is a legal commentator with the number one current affairs talk show in the country. We think you're absolutely riveting. We've been following your story since your assault a few months ago. We're such big fans, with an exclamation point. And the exchange continues where Donald, the character, is uncomfortable with this and asks if he can talk about the bigger issues rather than his own personal story. It's almost then as if Marsha isn't listening, and she listens a little bit, but continues with the same kind of email and offering the car and makeup and not really almost getting or grasping what the person she's asking is actually saying. And that's it's a powerful exchange, and it continues later in the book. Taking that character, Marsha, as indicative of a little bit of what you're talking about, what is it about the media that leads to this kind of glib treatment of serious subjects, or what you write in the book, the American media is nothing more than cars slowing down just long enough to take a peek? What explains the way they act or the way parts of the world of the media act on such crucial issues?
I think that they take, you know, look, it's both the good and the bad. And I think that the media is both complicit and complacent, but the media is also profoundly important in being independent watchdogs and making sure that, you know, that conversations do get the exposure that they need. The fact of the matter is that things like the Me Too movement, you know, that happened without the media. Yes, Jodi Kantor, you know, and the New York Times really broke that Weinstein story with Ronan Farrow. But at the same time, the actual movement itself post that story was all independently done by people on social media, which I think is pretty fascinating, because for the most part, you know, in order for people to really get a story out there and for that to affect anything, they have to go through journalists. And there is an important reason that that happens. There's a, you know, you want to be careful and make sure things are vetted and properly investigated. But I think it's really fascinating because much in that way, you know, after the Me Too movement really sort of launched itself, the media was able to amplify it and make it become even bigger. And that was a really important step, I think, in supporting it being actualized. At the same time, you know, they're the same ones that then, you know, Good Morning Joe and those type of programs are then bringing on people like Barry Weiss, who I take a lot of issue with, who want to come on and talk about how this movement is setting feminism back and making women, purporting women to be victims again, as opposed to being in control of their own lives, and talking about backlashes and witch hunts and starting to use that language. And so then you start to realize, like, oh, they're actually not really on the side of anyone. They are on the side of breaking news only. I think that's why Wolf Blitzer's Situation Room is so appropriate, because it is literally 24-hour nonstop breaking news, which is a joke. It is a joke. And to be able to look at it and say, you are creating a world in which there is no long-term support for anything that really matters, and that just from day to day it's about the breaking news, is problematic to me.
It's a little similar. I mean, when we saw all the police violence against African Americans, you know, from phones that then got broadcast on the media, which was very important. It offered a kind of look at what happens with policing that we didn't have in the late 60s, for example, where you actually saw the violence. But at some point, it became sensational. It was, the video itself was more interesting than the issues it raised and the kind of questions about how to stop it. And it seems to be a similar phenomenon, how these issues get swept up in our media discussions.
Yeah. And, you know, yes, that's absolutely true. It's not all like that. Mm-hmm. I think, as I said, that there's a lot of really good that a 24-hour news cycle also does, as far as accountability and making sure that nothing gets swept under the rug. Nothing just disappears. But still, I think that we have to examine it. And they are part of the culture. And they are, whether or not they like it, part of that rape culture at the same time.
And then you're an incredibly thoughtful artist. So how, and everything I'm sure is with great intention in the book. How did you decide to switch between all the different forms of telling the story? You know, again, the text, the emails, the straight narrative, the picture. What was the logic behind that?
Well, that's been, I've chosen to write that way, you know, outside of my pieces for the New York Times. I have chosen to write that way for a majority of my life. I've been a poet, you know, for a very long time growing up, and I am more fascinated by metaphors and analogies and trying to find new and different ways to convey feelings or opinions differently, uniquely. And so for me, even in the world of fiction, I thought, you know, this would be more interesting as a writer and to me as a reader, if not only were they the different voices of men, but then they were just the whole different styles of writing that also supported who those men were. I wanted the reader to be brought into all of these different lenses in looking at their interior lives. It was also important for me to make sure that the six men came from very different backgrounds, so that it was representative of the totality of experiences. You know, so that it was broad across the spectrum as far as different socioeconomical backgrounds, a different race, different gender, even all of it, and to make sure that it really represented men as a whole, and then one step further to also make sure that it wasn't just likable men. So it wasn't just, you know, the guy Donald Ellis, the character Donald Ellis, who is a former poet, school teacher, with very nice guy with two kids. You know, I wanted to also make sure that I included someone in there who was an alt-right provocateur, who was not very nice at all in the book. And I wanted the reader to really examine themselves and say, while I'm reading this, is there one person I think that doesn't deserve it and another one does? And so I wanted to look at that too, at sort of when somebody is a certain way, do we think that they are deserving of what has happened to them?
And it seems one of the threads of the book is that the narratives, the different characters are telling about themselves and struggling with in terms of what happened and why it happened. It's actually that storytelling that we all do about our past that's really at the heart of the struggle that takes place after the violence occurs.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that there is so much after the fact that is not explored or discussed. You know, there are basic experiences that are fairly common for people when they are after being sexually assaulted that are equally as bad, and that comes with you know, with the not being believed, with knowing that there will be no consequences, usually for the most part, for the person that has harmed you. You know, there are many different forms of saying the violence continues past the point of just the actual physical violence in the moment.
And part of the way they survive in the book a little bit is through each other and by trying to regain their sense of authority over the narrative that's being made by many other people other than themselves.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to me, the beautiful part of the book and the hopeful part of the book is exactly that, is the way in which some of these men, as, you know, emotionally stunted they are and or, you know, deeply empathic they are, they find a way to not only just, it's not come together, I feel like that's such the cliche term, but to reach out and understand each other. And some of them support each other, and other ones are just informed or inspired to even come forward by another person's story. And I think that sometimes that's all that we have. And that's kind of what made the Me Too movement, the inception of it, so powerful, is that it was a universal conversation amongst the survivors, who were all at once suddenly saying, I'm going to speak now. I'm not going to be quiet anymore. I'm going to speak now.
And we're getting close to the end of our time, but could you tell us a little bit about what Time's Up is, which you helped to create, and what kinds of activities it's been doing?
Yeah, so Time's Up, you know, for me, I feel like the formation of Time's Up as an organization happened. It happened January 1st of this year. It's still in its infancy. And it was founded so that no woman or man ever has to say Me Too again. And it is an action-based organization that works to fight and end sexual harassment and assault in the workplace across industries. It's very important for all the work that we've done that we make sure that it is inclusive and that it is far spread across many different types of job descriptions and workplaces. And one of the things that we did in the beginning of this year was we set up a legal defense fund through the National Women's Law Center. We've raised over $30 million, and that money goes towards working on cases and protecting women who want to come forward in different industries. So to make sure that they, you know, that they have a safe place where they can tell their story and also, you know, have justice ultimately.
And that's up and running already. I mean, it's already.
Oh yeah. There's, as of right now, the Legal Defense Fund had in the thousands of submissions as soon as it was announced after January 1st. And since that time, there's been about 300 cases that they have taken on. And they are extremely diverse and range in very different industries, from the tech world to the police force to the entertainment business.
And can I just ask one last question? In your world, in the world of entertainment, where we have all been reading about, do you think it's having the kind of impact it needs to, or is it still just revolving around a few of the most prominent figures?
Oh, I definitely think it is. And I think the fact that we're sitting here talking about it says that it does. You know, I've watched these powerful, amazing women who have been part of Time's Up. You know, I think we have to remember that, yes, you're seeing a lot of famous, predominantly white women who helped launch the face of Time's Up in the beginning. But the truth of it is that Time's Up is the most inclusive effort I have ever been a part of in my whole life as far as my activism concerns. And we have everyone from Tina Chen to Ai Jin Poo to Tarana Burke. The movement is wide and consists of many, many different people and activists from across industries, Monica Ramirez as well. And they have all been fighting to use the Time's Up name to create justice and space for their own industries, so that things will fundamentally change. And that's kind of the power of it, is that it doesn't belong to the term and the ideology behind Time's Up is that it doesn't belong to any one person. It belongs to everyone at the same time. And so the power is in the work that we collectively do, but also the work that we singularly do.
Well, thanks again to our guest, Amber Tamblyn. Her new book, it's really powerful, wonderfully written, and it's a penetrating kind of examination of these issues through a powerful story. It's Any Man, published by Harper Perennial. Book is available everywhere, online, in bookstores. So, Amber, thanks for joining our show.
Thank you so much, Julian, for having me.
And once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.